lying between the latter two cities, the strategy board found what it was seeking. Port Royal, the finest natural harbor on the southern coast, would float the navies of the world. Obviously, however, though they had no real need for it themselves, having almost no navy, the Confederates were thoroughly aware of what covetous eyes the Union Navy was casting in that direction. If it was to be undertaken, the job must be done in strength, after preparation in great secrecy. Both were provided for. The board took no chances it could avoid. The naval member himself, Captain Samuel F. DuPont, was appointed to head the expedition of 74 vessels, including transports for a land force of 12,000 men. In late October, sailing under sealed orders, this fleet put out from Hampton Roads, considerable pains having been taken to conceal its destination. Almost at once, DuPont was struck a double blow by fate, in the form of Confederate intelligence and the weather. He not only lost the advantages of secrecy, he came close to losing his fleet as well. On the day he put out, the Richmond government alerted its coastal defenses, giving warning that the force had sailed. 3 days later, November 1st, the defenders of the fleet's objective received a specific telegram. The enemy's expedition is intended for Port Royal. On the same day, the fleet ran into a gale off Hatteras. The wind approaching hurricane strength, two of the ships went down and the crew of a third had to heave her guns into the sea to keep from foundering. By dawn of the following day, November 2nd, the fleet was so scattered that DuPont could sight but one sail from the deck of his flagship, the Wabash. He continued southward, however, and in clear weather, 2 days later, dropped anchor off the bar at Port Royal. 25 of his ships had rejoined by then, together with reinforcements from the Charleston squadron, and others kept bobbing up along the horizon. He spent another 2 days replacing the rebel-destroyed channel markers, crossing the bar, a dangerous business for the deep-draft Wabash, completing his attack plan, and finally holding a conference at which he outlined for his captains the order of battle. At last he was ready, and at 8 o'clock the following morning, November 7th, the attack got underway. He knew what his wooden ships would encounter. At the entrance to Port Royal Sound, the enemy held Fort Beauregard, mounting 20 guns on Bay Point to the north, and Fort Walker, mounting 23 guns on Hilton Head to the south. Less than 3 miles apart, both of these forts were strongly built, their gunners alerted for a week, awaiting the opportunity DuPont was about to offer them. Somewhere beyond them, too, was a Confederate flotilla of 3 tugs, mounting 1 gun each, and a converted river steamer under Commodore Josiah Tatnall, whom DuPont knew to be a bold and capable officer, having messed with him in what was already known as the Old Navy. The forts were DuPont's main concern, however, and in attempting their reduction he would have no help from the 3 brigades of soldiers in the transports. Not only were these landsmen still somewhat green about the gills as a result of their experience off Hatteras, but in that storm, along with much else, they had lost nearly all their landing craft. It was to be a job for the naval force alone. In fact, DuPont preferred it so. The most he would ask of the army was that it stand by to help pick up the pieces. To accomplish the double reduction, he had evolved a novel plan of attack, an order of battle which divided his fighting force into a main squadron of 9 of the heaviest frigates and sloops, ranged in line ahead, and a flanking squadron of 5 gunboats. They would enter the Sound in parallel columns, the lighter squadron ranged to starboard, and pass midway between the forts, receiving and returning the fire of both. At a point about 2 miles beyond the entrance, the main force was to round by the south and come back west, moving slowly past Fort Walker, maintaining the heaviest possible fire, then round to the north and head back east, slowing again as it passed Fort Beauregard. The flanking squadron, meanwhile, was to peel off and engage the Confederate flotilla, or whatever targets of opportunity the rebels might afford, while the main force kept both forts under fire, widening the elliptical attack so as to bring its guns in closer on every turn. And so it was. At the signal from the commander on the Wabash, leading the way across the sunlit water, the fleet steamed forward, two columns in close order. A flash and a roar shot out from Fort Walker, echoed at once by Beauregard. The ships took up the challenge, and the fight was on. As they neared the turning point, Tatnall brought his four makeshift warships down the sound, and from a raking position let go several broadsides at the Wabash as soon as she came within range. The gunboats gave him their attention then, whereupon the Confederate, with 14 Union men of war to his immediate front, discreetly came about and made a swift, flat-bottomed retreat up Skull Creek, 3 miles northwest of the fort on Hilton Head. He was out of the fight for good, bottled up by the gunboats, which took station off the creek mouth. According to a Savannah newspaper published 5 days later, Tatnall dipped his pennant 3 times in jaunty salute to his old messmate, regretting his inability to return the high-flown compliments of Flag Officer DuPont in a more satisfactory manner. By then the Federal captain was busy elsewhere, with little time for compliments, high-flown or otherwise. As the main column turned south, beginning its first eastward run, each ship opened with its forward pivot against Fort Walker's northern flank, which DuPont had learned from reconnaissance was its weakest. The cannon being lodged on the parapet, which, if it increased their range, also increased their vulnerability. Several were violently dismounted, others lost their crews, and the gunners, taken thus by enfilade from a direction in which they had not expected to fight, were dismayed. A British correspondent on one of the Union ships saw tall columns of dust spring up from the fort to mark the hits the fleet was scoring, and it looked to him as if we had suddenly raised from the dust a grove of poplars. Not that the rebel gunnery had been very effective in the first place. The enemy ships, moving along their elliptical course with constant changes in speed, range, and deflection, were extremely hard to hit. What was more, the defenders had not wasted their scant powder on anything as unprofitable as target practice, and now that it came to bloody work, they found that many of the shells would not fit, the powder was inferior, and the crews became exhausted within an hour of opening fire. All of which, sad as it was in Confederate eyes, was really quite beside the point. Fort Walker, to which Fort Beauregard across the water was merely adjunct, had been built to be defended only from dead ahead, against a force moving straight in from the sea. When this became apparent, it became apparent, too, that the fight had been lost from the moment DuPont conceived his plan of attack. The only conditions left to be satisfied were those of honor. Erratic or deadly, the firing continued, and as the main squadron steamed slowly past Fort Walker, delivering broadsides at point-blank range, the flanking squadron, maintaining its watch over the mouth of the creek up which Tatnall had retreated, added the weight of its guns to the pressure against the vulnerable northern flank, its shells bowling down the line of metal on the parapet. Assailed from both directions by naval crews who worked with coolness and precision, more guns were dismounted, more men fell, the defenders fired even more wildly. The main squadron completed its first pass, closing upon Fort Beauregard, then swept down and around again, coming within less than 600 yards of the fort on Hilton Head, which had but 3 guns left in working order by the time the ships completed their second run. The Wabash was just rounding to the south, leading the way into a third ellipse, when DuPont received a message that Fort Walker had been abandoned. At 2:20, a naval landing party raised the Union flag above ramparts that were pocked and battered, strewn with wreckage left by men who would not sweat to keep from bleeding, and then had wound up doing both at once. Army transports now put in. By nightfall, troops had occupied the works. Across the way, Fort Beauregard hauled down its flag at sunset, and early next morning the troops crossed over and occupied it too. The victory was complete, and by it the Federal Navy gained an excellent harbor in the very heartland of secession. Nor was that all. Within the next 3 days the victors moved up the rivers and inlets and occupied the colonial towns of Beaufort and Port Royal, bringing under their control some of the finest old plantations in the South, and thereby affording an opportunity not to be neglected by their abolitionist brethren, who presently arrived and began conducting uplift experiments among the Negro field hands. The battle itself had not been without its romantic aspect, for one of the defenders had been Brigadier General Thomas F. Drayton, CSA, whose brother, Captain Percival Drayton, USN, commanded one of the attacking frigates. The South Carolina island for which they fought had been their boyhood home. Satisfying as all this was to supporters of the Union, the loyal brother having won, federal guns and federal notions were now in operation within 50 airline miles of Charleston, where secession had had its birth 11 months before. There emerged from the battle another fact which had, for those who understood its implications, more weight than all the other facts combined, heartwarming and romantic though they were. Against stiffer resistance, this third hammer blow had been even more successful than the other two. And nowhere had the fleet failed to seize any objective assigned by the strategy board. Some standard theories were going to have to be revised. The belief that one gun on land was equal to four on water, for example. Steam had changed all that, removing the restrictions of wind and current, and making possible such maneuvers as DuPont's expanding ellipse. From now on, apparently, the board had only to select its targets, concentrate the might of the fleet, and blast them into submission. Naval power was going to be a dominant factor in this war. 4. Coming as it did in the wake of defeats along Bull Run and Wilson's Creek, near opposite ends of the 1,000-mile-long fighting line, this triple victory hammered out by the Federal Navy did much to revive the flagging martial spirit of the North. There was no corresponding depression in the South, however, the odds in all three of these naval engagements having been too one-sided to give much cause for doubting the proved superiority of Confederate arms. It had been more or less obvious all along that the enemy could concentrate and strike with superior force at almost any point along the perimeter. That had been one of the conditions accepted by Davis when he chose the strategic defensive. When the pressure elsewhere was relieved, when the advantage shifted so that the South would be doing the concentrating and striking, the world would find out whether the North would be able to hold what it had won. Yet now, since that policy involved the dispersal of force to meet attacks from all directions, as the drawn-out fall wore on and the year was rounding toward a close, Southerners began to discover the price they would have to pay in the hard cash of lost chances for the advantages that accrued to the defensive. In late September, after Hatteras and Ship Island had been lost and a third such operation was probably already into the planning stage, Davis went up to Fairfax Courthouse for a conference with the victors of Manassas. While the blasted oaks on the battlefield to their rear turned red in the fine, clear weather of early fall, the men who had won that battle lay idle, watching the blue-clad host to their front grow stronger every day. At this stage, federal troops were joining at the rate of 40,000 a month, about the total effective strength of Johnston's army. Pinkerton, with his tabulated lists compiled by operatives in Richmond, had misled his employer badly. Yet McClellan had been right in his fears that he might be brought to battle before his soldiers were ready. Beauregard was planning an offensive. Though volunteering had fallen off to such an extent that the men arriving barely replaced those lost by the expiration of short-term enlistments and a liberal granting of furloughs, and though the army was crippled by a shortage of arms and supplies, food as well as munitions, he believed that the Northern Army, still in something of a state of shock from the whipping it had taken 2 months back, had perhaps now merely reached that stage of crystallization at which a smartly administered rap would cause it to fly apart again. In reply to the federal threat to divide and conquer the South by a descent of the Mississippi, Beauregard wanted to make a sudden thrust across the Potomac and divide the Union, east and west, by seizing the strip of territory lying between Pittsburgh and Lake Erie. When the Yankee army came out from behind its Washington entrenchments, he would administer the rap that would accomplish its disintegration, then go about his business of division and conquest. The odds were long, he admitted, but they were shorter than they were likely to be at any time hereafter, especially if the Confederates remained passive and continued to allow the growing enemy host time in which to regain its confidence. Such was his plan, and as Davis listened to it on the first day of October, closeted with the generals at their Fairfax headquarters, within 20 miles of Washington itself, Beauregard expounding and Johnston nodding approval, he could see its advantages, in spite of its abrogation of his claim that all we ask is to be let alone. Then came the rub. Beauregard declared that he would undertake the movement with 50,000 men while Johnston held out for 60,000, which meant that Davis would have the problem of finding 10,000 to 20,000 reinforcements for the invasion. The Federal Navy, having launched its first two amphibious operations, now was preparing a third, whose objective could only be guessed at. Every general in every department along the Atlantic and the Gulf, and what was worse, every governor of every state that touched salt water, which included all but 2 of the 11, not only believed that the blow would be struck, but was convinced that it would be aimed straight at him. They were calling loudly for help, and Davis could foresee the clamor that would follow any request that they forward troops to fatten the army now lying idle in northern Virginia. And with good cause, for in practically every case the political clamor would be followed by a military disaster. Down in North Carolina, for example, the loss of Hatteras had exposed New Bern, and the loss of New Bern would mean the loss of the Weldon Railroad, the only supply line between Richmond and the South Atlantic states. Without that line, the Virginia Army not only could not hope to mount an invasion, it could not even be maintained in its present position beyond 10 days. On the Gulf, the situation was almost as critical. The army being assembled and drilled at Pensacola might be considered available, but the recent seizure of Ship Island had exposed the nation's tender underbelly to assault, and that army was all that stood in a position to blunt the point of such a stab. Wherever Davis looked, the situation was such that to strip one area for the removal of troops to another would be to exchange possible success for probable disaster. Beauregard urged in vain that the length of the odds was an argument for, not against, the risk, that desperate men must take desperate chances, and that whatever was lost in the interim could be retaken after a victory on northern soil. Davis shook his head. No reinforcements could be sent, he said, without a total disregard for the safety of other threatened positions. The Creole could only shrug, while Johnston sat resigned, not being exactly a forward, cut-and-slash sort of commander in the first place. That ended all talk of a fall offensive, either along the Virginia line or elsewhere. For this year, at least, the nation was committed to the dispersed defensive, and Davis took the cars back to Richmond. He had troubles enough to vex him there, what with the day-to-day frets of office, the long nights rendered sleepless by neuralgia, and the fire-eaters shouting angrily that he had no policy that could even hinder, let alone halt, the southward crunch of the gigantic war machine the North was building unmolested. The cabinet he had assembled with such concern for political expediency had already begun to come apart at the seams. The brilliant and unpredictable Toombs, after hesitating to recommend the firing of the opening shot at Sumter, had bridled once the shot had been fired at being desk-bound while other men were learning the glad companionship of service in the field. On the day of Manassas, the issue being still in doubt in Richmond, where all that was known was that the guns were booming, he could abide it no longer. He submitted his resignation, as of that day, and left his post as head of the State Department to enter the Army as a Georgia brigadier. Within another 2 months, War Secretary Leroy P. Walker had done likewise, though for quite different reasons. Instead of feeling left out or insufficiently employed, the Alabamian had been employed beyond his capabilities, and he knew it. Swamped with work, trussed up in yards of red tape, he too departed for the field, where a man had only the comparatively simple threats of being killed or mangled. They would be missed, especially tombs, but their going gave Davis a double, or in fact, as he worked it out, a triple opportunity. As Attorney General, Judah P. Benjamin was largely wasting his talents, since the Justice Department no more had courts than the Postal Department, in the early months, had stamps. The War Office, which Walker had left in such a snarl, seemed the perfect field for Benjamin's administrative abilities. Accordingly, Davis shifted him there. This still left two vacancies, and in filling them, the president corrected another shortcoming. The all-important border states had come into the Confederacy in April, and all this time had been without representation in the cabinet, there having been no vacancy. Now that there were two such, Davis filled them with men of distinction from Virginia and North Carolina, Robert M. T. Hunter of the former and Thomas Bragg of the latter. The Virginian went in as head of the State Department, and the North Carolinian was given Benjamin's post as Attorney General. How Davis would get along with them remained to be seen. Like most of the old cabinet members, neither of the new ones had been intimate friends of his in private life before the war, nor were they now. At any rate, he had his family with him, established at last in what was called the White House of the Confederacy, not because it was white, it wasn't, it was gray, but because the president's residence had been called that under the old flag. A handsome, high-ceilinged mansion on the brow of a hill at the eastern end of Clay Street, with a garden to the rear, downhill, shaded by poplars and sycamores and the horse chestnuts his wife loved. Though the Virginia ladies looked askance and called her a Western belle behind their fans, Mrs. Davis, already heavy with the child she had conceived in Montgomery and would bear in Richmond in December, assumed her social duties with grace and charm. She was a credit to her position and a comfort to her husband. Yet even with her there to minister to his mental and bodily ills, the long hours and the constant strain were telling on his health and on his temper, both highly frangible in the first place. 20 years of public life had not thickened his skin against the pricks of criticism, and the past 7 months had even thinned it. At times he was like a flayed man in a sandstorm. His wife could overlook the sidelong glances of the FFVs, but to Davis any facial tick of disagreement became at once a frown of disapproval. He had lost none of the gracious manner by which he could charm an opponent into glad agreement, yet now he scorned to employ it, and turned snappishly upon any man who crossed him. Smarting under the goads of office, he fell out with whoever did not yield to him in all things, and any difference was immediately made personal. It had been thus even in the case of the two generals he had counseled with at Fairfax. Though nothing in their words or manner had shown this at the conference itself, all three being gentlemen and patriots who, in any given situation for which they had had time to steel their tempers, could place the national good above personal bias, Davis had shared a sort of running quarrel by courier with both of the ranking heroes of Manassas. Beauregard, with his bloodhound eyes and swarthy complexion, his hair brushed forward at the temples, Napoleonic in aspect and conception, eager for glory, Gallic and expansive, and Johnston, with his prim, high-colored, wedge-shaped face, his balding head, his gray-shot sideburns and goatee, Virginia proud, Virginia genial when he wanted to be, cunctative as Fabius Maximus, yet jaunty as a gamecock. These two had known the quick wrath and the withering scorn of the intellectual Davis in dispatches that were alternately hot or icy, but which in either case, when designed to sting, performed that function all too well. Gone was the glad comradeship they had shared on the field of Manassas, born of relief and exultation in that July twilight, while the Union flood ran backward up the roads to Washington. Since then, both men had fallen from presidential favor. Beauregard fell first. The man who had shown much modesty on his arrival at Richmond, with the laurels of Sumter still green on his brow, became a different man entirely when he took up his pen in the seclusion of his tent. After Manassas, talk had grown rife that the president had prevented any pursuit of the routed enemy. So rife, indeed, that Davis took the unusual step of asking his generals to deny the rumor officially. This Beauregard was glad to do, and promptly. But in his report on the battle, which unfortunately got to the newspapers before it reached the presidential desk, he reverted to his original scheme for combining the armies to crush the Union forces in detail, the plan which had been outlined by one of his aides at the First Confederate War Council, held at the Spotswood a week before the battle, with the implication that its having been rejected was the reason why the Southern Army was not in the Northern capital now. Davis would not let this pass. "With much surprise, I found that the newspaper statements were sustained by the text of your report," he wrote, and took the general to task. His last letter to the Louisianian had begun, "My dear General," and ended, "Very truly, your friend." This one opened with a frigid, "Sir," and closed with an ambiguous, "Very respectfully, yours, etc." The breach widened as the general's friends took up the cudgel. At last, in early November, Beauregard himself aired the grievance in a letter to the Richmond Whig. Headed, "Within hearing of the enemy's guns," it referred to the unfortunate controversy now going on, and said in part, "I entreat my friends not to trouble themselves about refuting the slanders and calumnies aimed at me. If certain minds cannot understand the difference between patriotism, the highest civic virtue, and office-seeking, the lowest civic occupation, I pity them from the bottom of my heart." However, the reaction was quite different from what he had anticipated. In reference to the Unique heading, for example, a rival paper asked, "Are we expected to give special credit to the general's lucubrations by reason of a fact certainly not very unusual in military operations?" The public, too, was disenchanted. A star had lost its luster. If Davis himself had chosen the words and directed the actions, the general could not have played more neatly into his hands. The Creole was unhappy anyhow. He felt cramped. No more than a supernumerary now that his army was merely a corps in Johnston's command. Practically overnight his dark hair was shot with gray, a phenomenon for which the different factions offered different explanations. Friends said that this was the result of overwork and heavy responsibility. Others attributed it to the blockade, which had cut him off from accustomed shipments of French hair dye. Whatever caused his graying, before the end of the year it was plain that he would have to go. Davis was considering sending him west, where he would find problems of such complexity that even his active mind would be kept busy, and there would be ample opportunity for him to exercise his talents, both with the sword and the pen. Trouble with Johnston had begun even sooner, all the way back in their West Point days, some said, when he and Davis were alleged to have had a fist fight over the favors of Benny Haven's daughter. Johnston won both the fight and the girl, rumor added, which might or might not have been true. At any rate, whatever had gone before, anger flared in considerable heat soon after the last day of August, when Davis forwarded to the Senate the names of 5 men to be given the rank of full general, lately provided for by law. The Senate confirmed them promptly and in the order proposed. Adjutant General Samuel Cooper headed the list, a 66-year-old New Yorker who had married south and crossed over from the old army, in which he had held the same position. Next came Albert Sidney Johnston, still on the way from California after resigning his U.S. commission, a Kentucky-born Texan whom Davis and many others considered the first soldier of the Confederacy. Third was Robert E. Lee, mobilizer and former commander of all the Virginia forces, now campaigning in the Alleghenies, charged with regaining what had been lost out there. Near the bottom of the list came Joseph E. Johnston himself, followed only by P.G.T. Beauregard, who came fifth. When notice of these promotions reached Johnston, he was outraged in his sense of equity and wounded in his pride. In the old army he had outranked them all, having been appointed quartermaster general with a staff commission as a brigadier, while they were only colonels. He saw no justice in Davis's assumption that seniority for line command must be based exclusively on line service, in which both Lee and the other Johnston had held their commissions. All he saw was that he had been passed over. Accordingly, while his wrath still smoked, he sat down and wrote a 6-page letter of protest addressed to Jefferson Davis as the author of his woes. After expressing his surprise and mortification, he wrote, "I now and here declare my claims that notwithstanding these nominations by the President and their confirmation by Congress, I still rightfully hold the rank of First General of the Armies of the Southern Confederacy." The order of names on the list, he added, seeks to tarnish my fair fame as a soldier and a man, earned by more than 30 years of laborious and perilous service. I had but this, the scars of many wounds, all honorably taken in my front and in the front of battle, and my father's revolutionary sword. It was delivered to me from his venerated hand without a stain of dishonor. Its blade is still unblemished as when it passed from his hand to mine. And much else in much the same vein of outraged virtue. He waited 2 days before sending it. Then, finding his anger still uncooled and remaining convinced of the trenchancy of his arguments and the fitness of the words he had used to advance them, he forwarded the letter unrevised. Davis read it with a wrath that quickly rose to match the sender's. This Virginian, rattling his father's sword between lines that spoke of his fair fame and his wounded front, outdid even Beauregard. In composing his reply, however, Davis employed not a foil but a cutlass. Rejecting the nimble parry and riposte of rhetoric and logic, at both of which he was a master, he delivered instead one quick slash of scorn. "Sir, I have just received and read your letter of the 12th instant. Its language is, as you say, unusual, its arguments and statements utterly one-sided, and its insinuations as unfounded as they are unbecoming. I am, etc., Jefferson Davis." Knowing Johnston, he knew the effect this letter would have. He knew that it would never be forgotten or forgiven, and that it must necessarily underlie a relationship involving the fortune, if not the very being, of their new nation. In writing and sending this reply, it was therefore as if he deliberately threw off center a vital gear in a machine which had been delivered into his care and was his whole concern. Yet his reasons, his motivations, were basic. Loving his country, he was willing to give it all he owned, including his life. But he would not sacrifice his prerogative or his pride, since in his mind that would have been to sacrifice not only his life, but his existence. There was a difference. It was not only that he would not, he could not. Without his prerogative, he would not be president. Without his pride, he would not even be Davis. Men interpreted him as they saw him, and for the most part they considered him argumentative in the extreme, irascible, and a seeker after discord. A Richmond editor later wrote, for all to read, that Davis was ready for any quarrel with any and everybody at any time and all times, and the suspicion goes that rather than not have a row on hand with the enemy, he would make one with the best friend he had on earth. Since Davis seldom chose to explain his actions, such explanations not fitting his conception of the dignity of his office, all too often the editor's charge seemed true. It appeared to be quite literally true in one case which came up about this time. He received from a general in the field a confidential report that a subordinate must be dismissed. This officer was an old friend of Davis's, and when he received the presidential order of dismissal, he came to Richmond to plead his case before the man who had signed it. "You know me," he said. "How could I ever hold my head up under the implied censure from you, my old friend?" Davis would give him no explanation, choosing rather to alienate a friend than to betray a confidence, or even infer that there was a confidence he could not betray. He told him, "You have, I believe, your orders. I can suggest nothing but obedience." And neither the friend nor the editor, nor for that matter the parlor gossips in Richmond, ever learned why this was done. Nor that Davis came home that evening suffering from the dyspepsia which was with him a symptom of nervous upset, and went to his room without eating.
In this dark autumn, while Beauregard and Johnston chafed and politicians grew bitter at having to accept disproof of their prediction that the war would be a 90-day excursion, Davis was disappointed by another general from whom he had expected much. Robert E. Lee's failure, however, came not because he was self-seeking or insubordinate. Lee was never either, but seemingly because he was incompetent in the field. The harshness of this judgment was emphasized by the contrast between what was done and what had been expected. When Garnet fell in western Virginia and his army scattered before the skillful combinations of McClellan, it became necessary for Davis to send someone out there to put the pieces back together. Lee was the obvious choice. A man of considerable handsomeness and moral grandeur, hero of the Mexican War, he was Virginia's first soldier. Though it was not widely known that he had been tendered command of the U.S. forces before his resignation to go with his state, it was a matter of general knowledge that his rapid mobilization of Virginia's troops had made possible the victory at Manassas. 1 week after that battle, he started west, taking with him the expectations of the president and the southern people. Federal military successes in the region had reinforced an earlier political maneuver. Back in April, when the Richmond Convention voted for secession, the Western members crossed the mountains and assembled in Wheeling, where, on grounds that by voting for secession the other members had committed treason and thereby placed themselves outside the law, they drew up a new constitution, elected a new governor, and petitioned Washington for recognition as the lawful government of the state. Lincoln, of course, welcomed them, and presently their representatives were occupying the Virginia seats in Congress and laying the groundwork for the creation of the loyal state of West Virginia. Nothing was more galling to Confederate Virginians than the presence of these men in Washington, and one of the things expected of Lee was that he would abolish the rump government which had sent them there. Strategically, too, the region was of great importance. Along its far edge ran the Ohio River, which not only was the traditional natural barrier of the new nation, but also flowed down toward the heart of Kentucky. Through its northern counties ran two vital supply lines, the Baltimore and Ohio Railroad and the Chesapeake and Ohio Canal. These severed, Washington would have to find a roundabout route for drawing men and supplies from the west. Still more important, with only a 100-mile neck of land dividing the northward jut of its tiny panhandle from the shores of Lake Erie, it was the best location from which to launch an offensive, such as the one proposed by Beauregard at Fairfax. That narrow isthmus also divided the Union east and west. To seize it would be to split the North in two. When Lee left Richmond, all these opportunities lay before him in the western mountains, and no one went on record then as doubting that he would accomplish everything to which he put his hand. What the public did not know was that he did not go out there to command, but to advise, to coordinate the operations of four small independent armies, whose commanders included one professional soldier, one scholarly ex-diplomat, and two high-tempered politicians. The campaign was to be conducted 70 miles from the nearest railhead, in an area whose population was largely hostile, and whose principal crop was mountain laurel, so that supplies had to be brought up over roads made bottomless by rain that seldom slacked. It rained 32 days in August, one veteran asserted. The troops were hungry and ragged, cowed by the defeats of the past month, half of them down with measles or mumps, and the other half lacking confidence in their leaders. It was here in the mountains that Lee encountered for the first time a new type of animal, the disaffected Southern volunteer. "They are worse than children," he declared, "for the latter can be forced." Nevertheless, with such material and under such conditions, he now tried to work with the first pair in his highly diversified quartet of brigadiers. The soldier, W. W. Loring, who had been there only a week, resented Lee's arrival as a sign that the government did not trust him, and the diplomat, Henry R. Jackson, though willing, was inexperienced. with the result that when Lee attempted to trap the Federals on Cheat Mountain by an involved convergence of five columns from the two commands, the soldier balked, the diplomat blundered, and nothing was accomplished except to warn the Union troops of the movement, which had to be called off. Failing here, Lee looked south, where the two politicians were independently arrayed. They were John B. Floyd and Henry A. Wise, both one-time governors of Virginia, the latter having occupied that office during the John Brown raid, and the former having gone on to become Secretary of War in Buchanan's cabinet. Floyd had shown a tendency to grow flustered under pressure, and Wise had indicated what manner of soldier he was by ordering a battery commander to open fire in woods so thick that he could see no target and could therefore do no execution. "Damn the execution, sir," Wise replied when the artillerist protested. "It's the sound that we want." These shortcomings were nothing, though, compared to the relationship that Lee discovered existing between the commanders when he arrived. With an eye for past rivalries and for possible future ones as well, the two ex-governors seemed more intent on destroying each other than they were on injuring the enemy to their front. Wise had raised an independent legion, and when Floyd, who outranked him, came into the district, he telegraphed Richmond, "I solemnly protest that my force is not safe under his control." Floyd, enjoying the advantages of such rank, countered by offering to swap Wise's legion for any three regiments of infantry, sight unseen. It was obvious that neither of these generals, intent as they were on mutual destruction, for which Floyd was perhaps the better equipped, having three newspaper editors on his staff, would be anxious or maybe even willing to cooperate in any venture which might bring credit to his adversary. Yet Lee did what he could. He designed another combined operation, this time up the Kanawha Valley, and finally got the two commands in motion. Whereupon, at the critical moment, with the enemy before them, the rivals took up separate positions, 12 miles apart, and, each declaring his own position superior, refused to march to join the other. Lee, whose primary reaction to the situation was embarrassment, was spared the ultimate necessity for sternness, however, when a War Department courier arrived with a dispatch instructing Wise to report immediately to Richmond. Wise pondered mutiny, but then, advised by Lee, decided against it and left, muttering imprecations. With his problem thus reduced at least by half, Lee assembled the forces and took up a strong defensive position, planning destruction for the Federals. He hoped they would attack. If not, then he would launch an attack himself. For 3 days he waited. On the fourth he found the woods in front of him vacant, the enemy having pulled back out of reach unobserved. All Lee could do with winter closing in was pull back too. The 3-month campaign was over, and he followed Wise to Richmond. It was over, and he had accomplished none of those things the public had expected. He had kept the advancing Federals off the Virginia Central and the Virginia and Tennessee railroads, but this was generally ignored in the shadow of the darker fact that, with all those bright prospects before him, he had not even fought a battle. A Richmond journalist reviewed the operation thus: "The most remarkable circumstance of this campaign was that it was conducted by a general who had never fought a battle, who had a pious horror of guerrillas, and whose extreme tenderness of blood induced him to depend exclusively upon the resources of strategy to essay the achievement without the cost of life." Lee had already written his wife, "I am sorry that the movements of our armies cannot keep pace with the expectations of the editors. I know they can arrange things satisfactory to themselves on paper. I wish they could do so in the field." And yet there was justice in the charge. Lee had been tender of bloodshed, designing complicated envelopments to avoid it, none of which had worked. Above all, he had shown himself incapable of jamming discipline down insubordinate throats. Besides, the journalist was reflecting general opinion. The public saw Lee now as a theorist, an engineer, a desk soldier, one who must fight by the book if he fought at all. and those who had watched with pride as he set out, expecting satisfaction for their hopes, now prepared looks of scorn for his return. They did not use them to his face, however. 3 months of adversity in the mountains had given him an austerity that would not permit familiarity, not even the familiarity of scorn. At 54 he had grown a beard. It came out gray, and people looked at him in awe. But beyond the influence of his presence, they sneered and called him Granny Lee and Evacuating Lee, and wondered what use could be made of a soldier who would not fight. Davis found a use for him as soon as he returned in early November, having learned in private the details of the campaign, details which the public did not know since Lee's delicacy, even toward men whose bickering had wrecked his reputation, would not allow him to include them in a report for the record. The president sent him to the South Atlantic coast, where his engineering abilities would be useful in improving the defenses. Hatteras Inlet and Ship Island had been lost, and a third blow seemed about to land. It landed, in fact, the day Lee got there. He arrived just in time to hear the guns at Port Royal and meet the fugitives streaming rearward from that fight. The Virginian could scarcely be blamed for this, yet a South Carolina matron wrote of him in her diary next day, "Preux chevalier, booted and bridled and gallant rode he, but so far his bonny face had only brought us ill luck." He believed more in work, however, than in luck. Having studied the situation, he strengthened some forts, abandoned others, and redrew the defenses, shifting them back from the sounds and rivers so that the invaders would have to fight beyond range of their gunboats. This called for digging, which Lee ordered done, and this in turn brought a storm of protest. His soldiers, especially the native South Carolinians, found the order doubly onerous. Digging wasn't fit work for a white man, they complained, and a brave man wouldn't hide behind earthworks in the first place. He put them at it anyhow, and as they dug, they coined a new name for him, King of Spades. Granny Lee, Evacuating Lee, the King of Spades, was one of several ranking Confederates who found their loyalty to Davis repaid in kind. Risking, sometimes losing, the affection and confidence of large segments of the people for their sakes, Davis sustained them through adversity and unpopularity, whether the public reaction seemed likely to reach an end or not. Obviously, this had its drawbacks. Then and down the years, depending on the critic's estimate of the bolstered individual, it was the quality for which he was at once most highly praised and most deeply blamed. Yet one advantage it clearly had for Southern leaders, with a value greatly enhanced by the fact that it was seldom available to their opposite Northern numbers. No man, knowing that Davis trusted him and knowing what that trust entailed, ever had to glance back over his shoulder, wondering whether the government, meaning Davis, would support him against the clamor of the disgruntled, or sacrifice him on grounds of political expediency. And if this was clear to the generals thus sustained, it was even clearer to the politicians, who knew that Davis would do his duty as he saw it. When legislation which they knew was bad for the country came before them, they did not hesitate to pass the measure if it was popular with the folks back home, knowing that Davis would exercise his veto. He employed it 39 times in the course of the war, while his opponent used it thrice, and only in one case was it overridden. Thus, in dignified silence, he shouldered the blame for men who called him obstinate and argumentative and did their worst to swell the chorus of abuse. His tenure was no longer merely provisional. On the first Wednesday in November, he and Stevens were elected, without opposition, to 6-year terms of office. Inauguration ceremonies were scheduled for Washington's birthday, which seemed a fitting date for the formal launching of the permanent government established by the Second American Revolution. That this government was permanent, in fact as well as name, Davis had no doubt. "If we husband our means and make a judicious use of our resources," he assured the Provisional Congress at its final session, November 18th, "it would be difficult to fix a limit to the period during which we could conduct a war against the adversary whom we now encounter." For that adversary, whose leader styled the Southern Revolution a rebellion and whose people now were submitting meekly to indignities no American had ever encountered without fight, he expressed contempt. If instead of being a dissolution of a league, it were indeed a rebellion in which we are engaged, we might find ample vindication for the course we have adopted in the scenes which are now being enacted in the United States. Our people now look with contemptuous astonishment on those with whom they had been so recently associated. They shrink with aversion from the bare idea of renewing such a connection. When they see a president making war without the assent of Congress, when they behold judges threatened because they maintain the writ of habeas corpus, so sacred to freedom, when they see justice and law trampled under the armed heel of military authority, and upright men and innocent women dragged to distant dungeons upon the mere edict of a despot, when they find all this tolerated and applauded by a people who had been in the full enjoyment of freedom but a few months ago, they believe that there must be some radical incompatibility between such a people and themselves. With such a people we may be content to live at peace, but the separation is final, and for the independence we have asserted we will accept no alternative. Yet even as he spoke, thus stigmatizing his opponent across the Potomac, Davis was faced with the necessity for emulating his tyrannous example. 2 days after the first Wednesday election, an insurrection exploded in the Loyalist mountain region of East Tennessee. Bridges were burned and armed men assembled to assist the expected advance of a Union army through Cumberland Gap. Though undeveloped industrially, the area was of considerable economic value as a grain and cattle country, offsetting the one-crop cotton agronomy farther south, and of even greater strategic importance because of the Virginia and Tennessee Railroad running through Knoxville and Chattanooga, westward to Memphis and the Trans-Mississippi. The insurrection confronted Davis with a problem much like the one that had confronted Lincoln in Maryland immediately after Sumter. And Davis met it with measures even sterner. Troops were sent at once from Memphis and Pensacola, resistance was quashed, and a considerable number of Unionists arrested. Habeas corpus, so sacred to freedom, went by the board. When the Confederate commander in Knoxville asked what he should do with these men, Davis had the Secretary of War reply that those insurrectionists, not actually known to be bridge burners, were to be held as prisoners of war. As for the burners themselves, they were to be tried summarily by drumhead court-martial and, if found guilty, executed on the spot by hanging. It would be well, the secretary added, to leave their bodies hanging in the vicinity of the burned bridges. 5 were so hanged, and others were held, including that William G. Brownlow, who earlier had said that he would fight secession on the ice in hell. Admittedly the leader of regional resistance, he was editor of the Knoxville Whig, and formerly had been a Methodist circuit rider, wherefore he was called Parson, an honest, fearless, vociferous man who neither smoked nor drank nor swore. He had courted only one girl in his life, and her I married. Though he was mysteriously absent from home on the night of the burnings, his actual complicity could not be established. He was held in arrest, for a time at least, until his presence proved embarrassing in the light of Davis's complaint about upright men dragged to distant dungeons in the North. Again through the Secretary of War, under the theory that it was better for the most dangerous enemy to escape than for the honor and good faith of the Confederate government to be impugned or even suspected, Davis directed that the Parson editor be released to enter the Union lines. Though he was thus denied the chance to recite the speech he had memorized for delivery on the gallows, Brownlow went rejoicing. "Glory to God in the highest," he exclaimed as he crossed over, "and on earth peace, goodwill toward all men, except a few hell-born and hell-bound rebels in Knoxville." Under his reek of fire and brimstone, there was much that was amusing about Brownlow, but there was nothing laughable about what he represented. Least of all was there anything comical about the situation he and his followers had created in the mountains of Tennessee. Now it had come to this, that Americans danced at rope ends as a consequence of actions proceeding from their political convictions. The harshest irony of all was that they were hanged by the direction of Jefferson Davis, who loved liberty and justice above all things, and who, as a grown man in a time of sickness, halted a reading of the child's story, Babes in the Woods. It was characteristic that he had never heard it, because he would not endure the horror of the tale. The operation on his high-strung nature of such incidents as these in Tennessee caused him to remark long afterward concerning his northern opponent's fondness for anecdotes and frontier humor, that he could not conceive how a man so oppressed with care as Mr. Lincoln was could have any relish for such pleasantries. He was afflicted, however, by troubles both nearer and farther than the stern, unpleasant necessity for jailing, banishing, and hanging insurrectionists in eastern Tennessee. Fire-eaters in Richmond and the Deep South, their claim to the spoils of higher offices denied, their policy of bold aggression rejected, were everywhere disaffected. Vocal in their disaffection, they had now begun to raise a multi-voiced outcry like the frantic babble of a miscued chorus. Charging that Davis had no policy whatever, they represented him as standing in a corner telling his beads and relying on a miracle to save the country. As caricature, the likeness was not too far-fetched, and the fact that the no-policy charge was true, or nearly true, did not make the barbs of criticism sting one whit the less. His critics would have had him strip the troops from threatened points and send them marching forthwith against the North, staking everything on one assault. To Davis, this not only seemed inconsistent with his repeated claim that the South was merely defending herself against aggression, it seemed unnecessarily risky. That way, the war might be quickly won, as Beauregard had pointed out, but it also might be quickly lost that way. Davis preferred to watch and wait. He believed that time was with him, and he planned accordingly, not yet by any means aware that what he was waiting for would require a miracle. At this stage, in Davis's mind, at any rate, nothing seemed more likely, more inevitable, than foreign intervention, as had been shown by his first action in attempting to secure it. Back in the Montgomery days, a month before Sumter, Barnwell Rhett, chairman of the Foreign Affairs Committee, reported a bill to Congress providing for the dispatch of a three-man mission to secure the recognition of the Confederacy by the European powers. Rhett had certain notions as to what these men should do over there, but he could not give instructions to such emissaries. The making of treaties rested with the president, who seemed to believe that nothing more would be needed than a polite call on the various proper statesmen across the water, whereupon those dignitaries would spread their arms to welcome a new sister bringing a dowry of precious cotton into the family of nations. This belief was emphasized by the fact that the man appointed to head the mission was William L. Yancey, the fieriest fire-eater of them all. For 15 years, the Southern answer to the most outspoken of Northern abolitionists, the Georgia-born Alabamian extended his defense of the peculiar institution to include a proposed reopening of the African slave trade, with the result that his name was anathema to every liberal on earth. In selecting Yancey to represent her, it was as if the South said plainly to all Europe, "To get cotton, you must swallow slavery." Nothing in his personality had shown that he would be armed with patience against discouragement or with coolness against rebuff, or indeed that he was in any way suited to a diplomatic post. Discouragement was not expected, however, let alone rebuff. Besides, Yancey, having declined the minor cabinet job of attorney general, the appointment solved the problem of what to do with him. Since that February evening on the gallery of the Exchange Hotel, when he presented the man and the hour to the crowd, no fitting use for his talents had been found. Now there was this. Though some declared that he was being hustled off the scene as a possible rival before the election of a permanent president came round. However that might have been, when he and his associates, Pierre A. Rost and A. Dudley Mann, received their instructions from the State Department, Something came over Yancey that seemed to come over all fire-eaters when they were abruptly saddled with the responsibility for using more than their lungs and tongues. Something akin to the sinking sensation that came over Roger Pryor, for example, when he was offered the honor of firing the first shot of the war. Returning from the conference, Yancey went to Rhett and told him of the instructions. They had agreed at the outset that the power to make commercial treaties was necessary to the success of the mission. However, the commissioners had not been given such power. All they were to do was explain the conflict in terms of the rightness of the Southern cause, point out the Confederacy's devotion to low tariffs and free trade, and make a delicate allusion to the probable stoppage of cotton shipments if the war continued without European intervention. Hearing this, Rhett shared his friend's dismay. "Then," he told Yancey, "if you will take my advice as your friend, do not accept the appointment, for if you have nothing to propose and nothing to treat about, you must necessarily fail. Demand of the President the powers essential to your mission, or stay at home." Whatever his qualms and misgivings, Yancey did not take his friend's advice. Sailing on the eve of Sumter, the commissioners reached England in late April to discover that the nation they represented was in the process of being increased from 7 states to 11, doubled in size east of the Mississippi, and more than doubled in wealth and population. Soon afterwards, May 3rd, they secured an interview with Lord John Russell, Secretary of State for Foreign Affairs, who had replied to their request for an audience that he would be pleased to hear them, but that, "under present circumstances, I shall have but little to say." The interview